Thanks for downloading our podcast. You can find out more about Tech Tent from our webpage. Go to bbc.com/programs/techtent. Hello and welcome to Tech Tent, your weekly status update on the technology business. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones. With me from the BBC Tech Desk this week are Dave Lee.
Hello.
And Jane Wakefield.
Hello.
And my very special guest is Kate Robertson, Global President of the advertising business Havas Worldwide, also founder of One Young World, which gathers young people from around the world to look for solutions to pressing problems. Welcome, Kate.
Thank you, Rory.
We'll be talking to Kate about tech brands and their value and an awful lot else too. And here's a quick taste of what's on today's menu.
Many people have thought that we have disappeared off the planet. That's, of course, not true.
No matter how much of our life moves online, we're always going to go like places to share a story.
For some people, there can be that stigma still associated with outsourcing love and having to pay for it.
Stay tuned for that and more. But first this week, a brave little Scandinavian business is taking the plunge into the competitive world of tablets.
A tablet for people who care about the details. The ones that value a perfectly balanced form. And for those who seek simplicity.
I'm the N1 tablet described in that advert. Well, it's something called a Nokia. Yes, the Finnish giant that used to control 40% of the world's mobile phone market and then sold its phone business to Microsoft. It was left with a solid but dull telecoms networks business. But now, just months after the Microsoft deal went through, it's getting back into the consumer market. I talked to Nokia's head of product, Sebastian Nyström, on the line to Helsinki, and I put it to him that this was all a bit of a surprise.
Many people have thought that we have disappeared off the planet. That's, of course, not true. You know, we have a strong networks business and a strong location business, but they're in the B2B space. So really what we announced this week is the return of the Nokia brand into consumers' hand through the first product, the Nokia N1 Android tablet.
Will people be confused, though, because they were very familiar with Nokia phones? They now think, oh, that belongs to Microsoft, possibly, if they know anything, or that it's gone away altogether. What value do you think there is left in the Nokia brand?
So I think people are actually used to the fact that Nokia provides various kinds of devices, all the way from the very simple and easy to use feature phones all the way to quite complex products. So I don't think that's going to be a challenge at all.
So you're starting off with a tablet. Are you eventually, when you're allowed to, going to be making smartphones again?
Well, that decision we'll have to make when the right time comes. We started off with a tablet as a way to get into the market. We felt that we developed an interface which was really easy to use and intuitive. And we felt that developing that for a tablet form factor where people use a lot of apps at home, it made a lot of sense for us to introduce that product at this stage.
We can't help noticing that your advertising and marketing for this product makes it look identical to an Apple iPad mini. Was that part of the plan?
Well, I think as the screen size increases on both smartphones and tablets, they by necessity become quite similar across all brands. So if you look at any two smartphones today or any two tablets, in general, they are relatively similar. If you want to develop a device that has a nice metallic feel to it, that then creates further similarity. But if you look at the details of the design that we have created, you can see quite a lot of difference from any other device out there.
Do you think Apple are going to be cross because the web page that you've set up looks identical to sort of Apple style? It's all on a white background. Even the images look very similar to the way they've marketed the iPad.
I think this is something that if you look at the pages that we have had before, they've also looked quite similar. So we've stayed true to a lot of the style that we had before.
And aren't Microsoft going to be cross? They bought the brand. They seem to have dropped the brand already for their phones, but they've not got much value out of Nokia, have they?
Well, Microsoft, they have a brand license from Nokia, and they've been very clear that they will continue to benefit from the appeal and the promise of the brand for consumers in the feature phone space. They will continue to make those devices under the Nokia brand. So Microsoft's success is really our success in this case. And I go back to what we talked about earlier around, will people be confused? No, I don't think so. Nokia has provided a broad range of products before, and we can continue to do that.
Sebastian Nyström of Nokia, completely unfazed by the idea that Various people may be disturbed. Kate Robertson of Havas Worldwide, you spent a career in the advertising industry. Can brands come back in this way? Can Nokia, which has seen its brand value plummet, can it rebuild that?
I think in one case out of 100, it could happen. But what's interesting about this, I think, was just listening to your interview with Nestrom there, is how disingenuous that is. Because you start opening sentences, we've made it intuitive and easy to use. That always was, way back in 1984. You probably don't remember, Rory, but I certainly do. That was Apple's go-to thing, easy to use, intuitive. It's not an accident that everything they've done looks like Apple. And sorry, there may be differences in the detail. To me, it looks absolutely deliberate. In terms of a comeback, though, if you really want a comeback, there will have to be some distinction at some point.
And they can't be a Me Too brand.
You're going to need a lot of money. But I tell you what, something, reading your piece earlier, that user base in India is not to be sniffed at. Nokia's user base in India, that is, you're talking about big numbers of consumers. Somewhere down the line, if that could generate the cash, but it's going to need a lot of cash.
Kate kindly mentioning the piece I wrote about this, which is on our website, bbc.com/technology. Moving on, a few weeks back, I met the chief executive of Uber, the fast-growing car service. And I put it to Travis Kalanick that his company's aggressive tactics had given it quite a big image problem. This is how he responded then.
I think we just have to do a better job of showing, you know, Uber's good side. Not necessarily changing who we are, but just making sure people see that we're doing good and we feel good about it.
So how's that going? Not well, after what must be the worst week in PR that any Silicon Valley company has suffered in recent years. Let's work out what's gone wrong with Dave and Jane. Dave Lee, first of all, it was kicked off with a dinner at which an Uber executive said some indiscreet things to a journalist.
Yeah, very indiscreet. So picture the scene here. A few journalists and a senior editor at BuzzFeed, which broke this story, were invited to dinner with some Uber executives. You know, the food and wine started flowing, discussion was getting live, and they turned to the media coverage of the company and the types of things people were writing. And it was at this point that an Uber executive called Emil Michael said he wanted to hire researchers to secretly dig up dirt on journalists' private lives. In particular, one journalist named Sarah Lacey, who's a well-known reporter in Silicon Valley, who had she'd been writing articles about Uber, and at one point she called the service unsafe for women, and obviously that angered Uber quite a lot. Now, Emil Michael's reporting is suggesting using those researchers to find things out about Lacey's private life. Now, by Monday of this week, Uber had distanced itself from those reported comments. Emil Michael said his comments didn't reflect his actual view.
He didn't mean it.
Absolutely. While the Uber chief executive, Travis Kalanick, who we heard at the start there, he said in a tweet, he said, quote, his views were terrible and did not represent the company.
So is Sarah Lacey the target of that? Is she happy?
No, safe to say she isn't. She's very disturbed by it. But, you know, beyond her own personal involvement, she says this is a test of some of Uber's very high-profile investors. I mean, companies like Google are among them. And she's saying they should use their influence to change the company. Here's what she said about it in an interview with Bloomberg TV.
This story is fascinating because it is a litmus test for Silicon Valley investors and do they have a conscience over money? It is a litmus test for journalists and will they stand up and say you cannot dismantle us and does the First Amendment matter? And it is also a litmus test for the public.
But Uber's troubles don't end there, do they, Jane?
No, it's definitely a week they want to forget. So on Wednesday it emerged that the firm was investigating a New York executive for tracking a BuzzFeed reporter without her permission, which raised a whole bunch of questions about what the firm does with user data. It has a tool, rather scarily known as GodView, although it's worth pointing out that this is a well-known industry name, not something that Uber has dreamt up. But the tool allows employees, not drivers, just employees, to track the location of vehicles, and it's claimed that Uber executive Josh Mohra told a BuzzFeed reported that he'd been tracking her as she used an Uber car to come to an interview with him. The question is whether he had any right to track her in this way, but it also raises wider questions about what Uber does with user data. It said it has a strict policy and data can only be accessed for legitimate business purposes, but I suspect that won't entirely satisfy its critics.
And Kate Robertson, what do you think has happened to the reputation of this company and will it have any impact on its business, which does continue to grow at an astounding rate?
Continues to grow because they are price competitive at a level that nobody seems able to sort out. So that's That's the big good thing, I suppose, about Uber. It ought to damage their reputation. Frankly, it ought to put them out of business. Will it? I think the reporter there made a good point about a litmus test for the consumer. I think for women, I think for Kalanick, I cannot believe he didn't fire the guy. What on earth do they think they're doing? The scary thing is, and you have to ask, how long is that business going to survive? Because it is so gobsmackingly stupid what they did and what they said. You're at the Waverley. That's Graydon Carter's place. You know, Scuttle is traded there. What were they doing?
Time will tell. They've still got a valuation of $17 billion, so one can't see that evaporating in a hurry. But moving on, Jack Dorsey is the founder of one company that has had a huge impact on the way we communicate, and another with ambitions to transform the way we pay. Twitter is the first of those, Square the second. Mr. Dorsey's in London today to promote Square's move into Europe as a provider of software, which gives small businesses a kind of virtual cash register. But what Square isn't doing is expanding its mobile transactions business to new markets. And I put it to Jack Dorsey when we met in a London coffee shop that his latest business sounded, well, a little uninspiring.
Well, we think the software, the cash register that we've built, which is the equivalent to any of those cash registers you see on the counter, and actually has a whole lot more power, now fits into your phone or into your tablet. And we think that has so much more potential and power than just payments alone. What happens before the transaction, what happens after the transaction, is so much bigger and so much more impactful for every business.
That sounds... It will sound to many people like a much less ambitious and world-changing mission than you were on with Twitter. What do you say to that?
I would disagree with it. I mean, just think about how many cash registers you encounter on a daily basis. Think about how a seller is actually interacting with that and the information or lack of information within that to actually grow a business. So no matter how much of our life moves online, we're always going to go like places to share a story. Unfortunately, or fortunately for us, not a lot of people are looking at that countertop.
And what's it in you that made you want to do this? I mean, you were a penniless kind of guy who got into Twitter and that made your huge fortune. You should have gone and lain down on the beach and relaxed a bit, shouldn't you?
No, I mean, I love working on things that are fundamental, and communication is definitely a fundamental in humanity. It's essential, and I think commerce is as fundamental and as essential to humanity, to civilization.
Twitter has had a huge impact, as I said. It's now running into all sorts of criticism. What would you say to those who say that social media in general has had a negative impact on our world, on our ability to relate to each other? It's been a forum for argument, for bullying, and for general nastiness.
I think it's ultimately all these tools, not just Twitter, but any technology, is a reflection of our civilization, what's happening in the world. And what I'm proud of is at least we're having the conversation. We're having a conversation now around bullying. We're having a conversation now around abuse. And we can see the results of that even faster. And hopefully that means we can fix them and address them even faster. But I don't agree that it abstracts away a relationship. I think it actually helps make a relationship deeper. And in the best moments, Twitter actually brings more people together physically.
The other accusation from the intelligence agencies is that Silicon Valley technology companies, including Twitter, have become the command and control system for terrorists. So as chairman of Twitter, if the NSA, GCHQ, etc., come to you and say you're not doing enough to help in the battle against terrorism, what do you say to them?
We're all public, so go to twitter.com and check things out.
And the culture of Silicon Valley, is that a positive culture right now? We're hearing a lot of stuff about a so-called frat boy culture, aggressive male culture. We've got the boss of Uber under fire for remarks made about journalists. Does that worry you?
I don't think one individual company represents the entire culture, although it can easily be taken out of context. There's a number of companies that have done amazing things around diversity, a number of companies who have done amazing things around women in leadership positions in engineering. Square, for instance, over 54% of the company is led by women. So we're very proud of this. And one company doesn't represent the entire culture of Silicon Valley or San Francisco.
That's Jack Dorsey, founder of both Twitter and Square. This is Tech Tent on the BBC World Service. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones. Still to come, the role that India has to play in bringing the next billion people online. First, a couple of big cybersecurity stories this week. Dave Lee, news of a global police operation against cyber crooks.
Yes, Rory. Across Europe this week, a handful of people were woken up by this.
Open the door, it's the police!
That's the noise, the very loud noise of officers from the UK's National Crime Agency. They played their part in a coordinated raid on people allegedly using so-called ratting technology. Now, ratting is the name given to people who use malicious software to remotely take control of people's computers, often with the intent to steal information or, more creepily, spy at people through their webcam. 15 people were arrested in total, 4 of them in the UK, 11 in countries across Europe, but I'm sure you can agree it's probably just the tip of the iceberg for this kind of thing. Mm.
And Jane, I've got my home webcam up in front, sort of monitoring the dog. Is anybody else going to be looking at that, according to a story that broke this week?
Well, there's a Russian-based site that apparently is transmitting live feeds from baby monitors, standalone webcams and CCTV systems. So if you've got yours securely locked down, then no. But if not, then yes. And it's a bit worrying. There's images including of a child's bedroom in one case. So the watchdogs around the globe are warning about this and saying, you know, working to get this site shut down. The site says that it's just doing it so that people can see what the risk is if they don't secure the webcams.
Messages, put a password on your webcam, please. I don't want you looking at my dog on over the internet. Now, the internet revolution is gathering pace with a big drive to get the next billion people online. And much of that growth is expected to come in Asia. But as more and more traffic flows across the internet, there are always questions over whether its basic infrastructure will be able to cope. One of India's biggest technology companies, Tata Communications, is investing big sums in cables and in cloud computing. But I asked the firm's chief executive, Vinod Kumar, whether he thought there was a danger that the internet would run out of capacity.
I believe that both the technology as well as the service providers like us are up to the challenge. We can't rest easy. We need to be extremely vigilant and constantly innovate to make sure that we're deploying the latest technology and at the same time deploying multiple kinds of technology.
Isn't there a concern in India about China and how much faster China appears to be growing in this area than India? Why, for instance, have we not got an Indian company like Alibaba?
I would say that, yes, there is some concern and envy, but it's just a challenge that the Indian entrepreneur has to step up to. What I have witnessed in the last 12 to 18 months is a lot of young, bright minds leaving universities and going straight into tech, starting their own companies. You've seen companies like Flipkart and Snapdeal more recently that have introduced very creative business models around e-commerce, but adapted to the Indian consumer. Yes, we don't have an Alibaba today, but I expect in the next decade we'll have something like an Alibaba.
Isn't there a lingering problem in India with regulation and government interference? Is India welcoming enough to some of these new ideas?
I believe the new government is, one, very pro-business, and secondly, the Prime Minister Modi and his cabinet are also quite tech-savvy. Even the way they ran their campaign and the way they're approaching solutions to some of the larger problems that India faces, like financial inclusion, are based on leveraging technology. I'm fairly bullish, along with many other business leaders in India, that what we're going to see over the next 5 to 10 years is a period when government will come up with policies that are more business-friendly, focus on the right governance, try and eliminate corruption, and free up the shackles that have held back some of the businesses.
Finally, if there was one thing that you could change about the landscape for technology in India, what would it be?
It's an interesting question. The thing that will be most beneficial is driving penetration of the internet into rural India and making services available to a very thirsty population that is curious, willing to spend, and also avail of the best of technologies. It will bring so much improvement to education, healthcare, and in general, both the economy as well as the larger society.
Vinod Kumar of Tata Communications being optimistic about the impact of technology there. Kate Robinson, as well as Havas Worldwide, you founded this One Young World organisation. That is optimistic, isn't it, about what young people might be able to achieve perhaps through technology and other means?
It's optimistic, but it's also realistic. There's most connected, most informed, most educated generation in history. You know, if you look at the infrastructure spine of the Arab Spring and other things that we know about, I think the thing where One Young World for me is hopefully an important contribution to it is that social media's role in all of the revolutions and uprising and Occupy movement itself is an interesting thing, but there are never leaders of those things. And that's a problem. Just think about it. Leaders don't emerge from those things. It's a strange culture around the social media movements that doesn't allow or need a leader. It's interesting. When it translates from virtual to real world, there's a sticking point.
Well, we'll come back to a little chat about the culture of technology and its impact on the world if we've got time at the end. But first, what's the one thing that never changes for those frantic young entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley? Yes, it's that the workaholic culture that makes it impossible for many to find love. The writer Robert X. Cringely even made it part of the title of his 90s book, Accidental Empires, How the Boys of Silicon Valley Make Their Millions, Battle Foreign Competition, and Still Can't Get a Date. Apparently that still holds true, but one celebrity matchmaker is offering to help love-starved tech titans, as Melanie Sevchenko reports.
All it took was one blind date for a San Francisco entrepreneur to find his match. The couple has been together for over a year now, thanks to Silicon Valley's Lynx dating service, the brainchild of premier matchmaker Amy Anderson.
Especially out here, there are a lot of fairly engineering-oriented guys and girls, you know, who do very much fit the traditional antisocial nerd profile and need as much help as they can get.
I met up with this Lynx client, who declined to offer his name, for a stroll around San Francisco's Marina District. He says he's used other dating services like eHarmony and OkCupid, but none were as effective as Anderson's expertise.
She meets you, she analyzes you, she figures out what you're looking for, which may or may not be what you say you're looking for, and then she sends you on dates. She tells you the rules, you will pick her up on this date, you will pay for dinner.
But for those in power positions, finding true love might come with a cost, literally. To be a premier member of Lynx, which means a guaranteed number of matches, prices start at $20,000 and can reach up to $100,000. With costs that high, Anderson's opinion has come to matter in the Bay Area.
When you have this woman who both parties respect, Amy, saying, okay, you are going to like this girl, you are going to like this boy, go out together. You have immediately, both of you are at the top of each other's stack.
Internet matchmaking is now a $1 billion industry in the United States, according to Harvard's Kennedy School, with one in three people finding their current partner online. Already years ago, Anderson was amazed by the sheer volume of eligible professional men in Silicon Valley who were single versus the ample amount of eligible women. The concept behind Lynx was to bridge that gap.
I think most men in Silicon Valley are living and working in Silicon Valley. And so as such, they're workaholics. Their social life tends to be that with colleagues, but there's not a lot of social interaction with women. So it can become very limiting.
I met Amy Anderson and her team member, Michael Norman, outside a cafe off a busy highway in her native Marin County, just north of San Francisco. Along with matchmaking, Anderson also coaches her clients on dating etiquette and appearance.
Amy has actually at different times done like home inspections basically for some of our bachelors and been like, no, this is actually your, you know, you have to have hand towels in your bathroom and you should have these very basic items in your refrigerator in case you end up having a date in your home and you need a couple of pillows on your couch and maybe you need a couch and maybe you really... need this to look like you've lived here for, yeah.
Lynx's list has reached over 700 clients, 50-50 men and women, from people in their 20s to upwards of 70 years old.
one of the major reasons that they sign up for Lynx is our vetting. We are serving as their huge filter, just weeding out so many potential mismatches.
And from what Anderson can assess, it's working. She constantly receives updates from Lynx couples that are engaged or married. And in the past month, two babies were born from Lynx introductions. Of course, long-term success is hard to gauge.
Some people are private and they want to almost forget how they ended up meeting their match. For some people, there can be that stigma still associated with signing up for a dating service, and outsourcing love and having to pay for it.
Melanie Shevchenko reporting there. There were some laughs echoing around the studio. Kate Robinson, what does it say about the Silicon Valley male culture? Is it changing at all?
I don't think that it actually is. I mean, listening to Jack there, you know, and Jack's a friend and he's a One Young World counsellor and in the flesh is an incredibly attractive man.
Jack Dorsey.
Yeah. But listening to your interview with him, you know, we were just saying just now, does Jack sound like a nerd? He sounds like a nerd, you know? Maybe it's too much time spent at the computer.
Jane, what are your impressions of Silicon Valley men?
Well, I've just spent a day with a load of Silicon Valley billionaires, funnily enough, when I went to the Singularity Summit in Amsterdam. And they are a very different breed from any men that I would normally hang out with, I have to say. Very passionate about their technology, but I think, you know, that comes first, second, third, fourth in their lives. And, you know, love doesn't necessarily
change.
Changing
nerd culture is not going to be easy. We're running out of time once again. Thanks to Kate Robinson, our special guest, to Dave Lee and Jane Wakefield. You can read their stories at bbc.com/technology. And I hope you'll join me again in the tech tent at the same time next week.